It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery...
It wasn't the feeling I was getting. It was the lack of feeling that I was chasing. Like, I didn't want to feel. You know, so whatever it was, like, I wasn't chasing the high, so to speak. I was chasing the numb.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. It's brought to you by our friends at KnowYourScript.org. KnowYourScript.org has been a sponsor with us for a long time, and without their support, we wouldn't be able to do this weekly podcast. So go check them out, KnowYourScript.org. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
So, you know, the first part of the podcast is where we kind of check in with each other, see what's going on, and mm-hmm. I usually kind of give you some insight of what my week is looking like and things that I've encountered. And right. I've got a couple of things, but I was driving down here today, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, because it's just, there's been a lot going on, but not really a lot to talk about. And then somehow we got to talking about my girlfriend.
Right.
The lovely Leslie.
Yes.
And so last night, I had a sleepover.
Oh, a sleepover, huh?
Yeah, I was sleeping over at her house, and we were watching some scary movies, and we went to bed, and I woke up this morning, and I stretched my arms out, and something felt weird.
Yeah?
The lovely Leslie wasn't in bed with me.
Oh.
She wasn't in the bed.
She's up making you breakfast.
No. So I put on my gym clothes, I'm ready to go to the gym, and I go out, and there she is sleeping on the couch.
Wow.
And I was like, hey, why are you sleeping on the couch?
You guys had burritos last night?
No. Okay. It wasn't. I wasn't flatulent. I guess I was snoring.
Snoring. Okay.
So loud that she was like, I think it's going to be better if I sleep on the couch.
That's interesting, because I think the tradition, if there is one, is
take your snoring butt out to the couch.
Yeah, she kicks you out, right?
But we were talking about that, and it made me think. I'm ashamed to say it, but for a good portion of my marriage, I slept on the couch.
Yeah, because of snoring or?
Well, no, because of my drinking.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. To where I'd come home and I'd been drinking and I wanted to get in bed and I'm sure I smelled like a bar and probably wasn't, you know, the nicest or just a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
Where she goes like, you go sleep on the couch.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, okay, I'll go sleep on the couch because then I can watch what I want to watch because you don't ever let me watch scary stuff.
Yeah.
So I would go sleep on the couch and every morning I'd wake up on the couch.
Yeah.
And I would be in my head. And when you're a married person, that's not where you want to sleep.
No.
You know, even when you're dating somebody. That's a
common couples therapist question is how often do you sleep apart? You know, one person on the couch or in the guest room or something.
And so, I told the lovely Leslie this morning, I go, hey, you know, you could have made me go sleep on the couch. There's no sense for you. You know, I mean, I was the one snoring. She goes, I just didn't want to wake you.
Ah, sweetheart. That's awfully nice of her.
And that is nice. But it got me thinking, and it's crazy how stuff like that, I can look back and see patterns and things that I did that were destructive mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. I didn't really think that they were. I mean, I used to think I was winning the argument when I went and slept on the couch.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
Somehow you sleeping on the couch felt like a win, huh?
It did.
Pretty drunk.
In my addicted brain, it did.
Yeah.
Because you know what I did? I got to do what I kept doing.
Ah, okay. So you're like, I've justified and I can keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So
that's the addict brain right there, is that irrational decision making that feels rational.
Yeah. And you can justify and rationalize just about anything.
Sure.
We've had so many people who've come and sat in on this podcast who said they found themselves doing things that they could never imagine themselves doing.
Oh, yeah. Lots and lots of things. I mean, you know, hiding your behaviors.
Stealing from families.
Oh, yeah. Stealing from families is a big one.
Homelessness.
Even homelessness. Isn't that amazing that a person could, that addict brain could justify sleeping in the park?
You know, and it's amazing is that we've had people sit down on this podcast who went from nice homes to homelessness within less than a year.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you would have sat somebody down and said, hey, look, man, I got this drug. It's going to make you feel awesome. But listen to me. In less than a year, you're going to be homeless. Do you still want to do it?
Yeah, if there was truth in advertising.
If there was, but I mean, but that's the reality of it. Isn't it goes like, oh, by the way, you're going to feel awesome, but you're going to lose respect from your family. You're not going to see your kids.
Lose your job.
Yeah.
Kids will hate you.
Yeah.
Get divorced.
And you're going to end up living on the streets.
Yeah.
You still want it?
I thought about that driving in today as well. You know, we got a little bit of snowstorm first of the year going on. It's pretty cold. And I did think, I'm like, oh my gosh, what about all the people that didn't have a place to sleep last night and they're sleeping out in the cold? That would be just such a terrible situation. And we've had a lot of those folks here on the show.
Do you want to hear a little rehab inside secret?
I do.
That's when a lot of people search for recovery.
Well, that makes sense.
In the cold months.
When you get
months,
uncomfortable enough.
In the cold months, they go, well, I need to find somewhere to stay. I can't sleep on the streets. It's going to be snowy.
Well, I think it's interesting that you shared that story, though, because we're now talking about homelessness, which is pretty extreme, right? You know, sleeping outside, having nothing to your name and all of that. But you were justifying sleeping on the couch. That's not that many steps away.
No.
I mean, it's the same mentality on a lesser degree on the scale, right?
Yeah.
Like, you think you're winning. You're like, I'll show her. And you happen to have a couch and a TV. But, I mean, if your drug maybe had been more severe, more intense, if you had gotten into the opiates and things like that, you might have carried that same attitude out into the park.
Or into my car, or into, you know, to a friend's house, or whatever it is. But that's how the addict brain works.
Yeah.
I mean, it is absolutely scary.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting that, you know, that every once in a while in normal conversation, I'll have something and then something will kick back and I'll be like, oh.
Make that connection.
Make that connection.
So tell me what's the plan going forward. A, did lovely Leslie invite you for another sleepover, or are you on hold? B, what are you going to do about your snoring?
Well, so my snoring comes in cycles. You know, when I was a little bit more overweight, I used to snore a lot.
Sure.
And I think I have a stuffy nose, so I'm going to blow my nose before I go to bed. And if
Do you ever rinse? Do you get that?
Neti pot?
Well, neti pots are so involved. You can just buy saline in the pressurized can.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I do.
I don't know. Maybe I'll try that.
That's way easier than a neti pot.
I'm going to try to sleep on my tummy.
So you think that'll help?
I think if I'm sleeping on my tummy, I don't snore as much.
Okay.
And I think I was sleeping on my back.
Sleeping on your back is always the worst.
I think I'm gonna try to blow my nose and sleep on my tummy.
Blow your nose, sleep on your tummy, talk her into having you over again.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I can talk her into having me over.
All right.
Remember, this is the girl who stuck with me by... Stayed with me through rehab. Showed me around for a year when I didn't have a license.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, lovely Leslie doesn't even begin to describe her patience and kindness.
You know, a lot of people say they want to ride or die, and that means you want somebody that's going to ride or die with you. You want a ride or die chick. Leslie's a ride or die.
Yeah.
She's pretty good.
No, I agree.
One more thing before we get to our guest. He's got an amazing story. We both met him about 3 years ago, and I'll remind you how we did that in a little bit.
Okay. Wow.
But I found myself super, super busy over the past 3 months.
Yeah.
And I found myself slipping back into old habits.
Mm.
Like where I now need to kind of sit back and go, okay, what are we going to do about this? And the habit was trying to make everybody happy.
Oh,
with speaking engagements, with DJ jobs, with everything that I've got going on with Mountain View Tidal and Minky Couture, trying to make everybody happy. I'm a yes man.
You're an accommodator.
Yeah.
And you know, both of us struggle with that.
And people say this, and my brain's like, we can't do this. We can't do it. My mouth's like, yeah, no problem.
I think the problem for me, and we've talked about this before, is saying yes. Like you're always looking for an opportunity to say yes because you want to accommodate, and that makes other people happy.
I like being of service.
When other people are happy, then you feel good because they're happy with you.
Yeah,
you know, and you do want to do all those things that people ask you to do, but for different reasons, I think both of us find ourselves saying yes before we really think whether it's possible.
So I find myself in that situation quite a bit lately of people asking me to do speaking engagements.
You've had a huge influx of people wanting your services in the last few months. I agree.
And so I want to do it. And one thing is I don't want to say no because I don't want them to be like, well, that's BS, man. We supported you through all this. We just want to hear your story.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, I want you to hear my story. I want to be able to speak to as many people as possible. But I've also got to find a happy balance. I've also got three kids.
You can't
kids.
Do it every night of the week.
I've got three kids. I've got a girlfriend. I've got an ex-wife. I've got a mother. I've got brothers. I've got you guys. I've got friends. And I'm trying to fit it all in.
And it's not little stuff. I mean, last week you spoke at a big gala down at the Grand America Hotel.
Yeah, with Alema Harrington and Randall Carlyle. And as Susan, who was a guest on this podcast, mm-hmm. sent me a nice note saying thank you very much. And we raised more money than we ever have. And that money is going to help people find sober living.
Which I think is one of the best places you can donate money to, is helping people get a scholarship for sober living so that they can continue to be successful after a recovery program. And I wish I could have been there. I really tried to pull myself together, but that was in that week of post-COVID.
Yeah.
And I was so exhausted. I'm still not 100%
energy-wise. And I told everybody that, you know? And they said, wish you well.
But the pictures made it look amazing. But I bring that up just as an example for the listeners that it's not just a little thing here and there. There are some big events that you've been doing.
And I love being asked, and if I can do it, I will make it work. But I had to sit down and talk to myself and go, hey, look, Case, you can't say yes to everything. And so the lovely Leslie printed me out a calendar. And so when people call, I write it down. And then before I say yes, I go, let me check my calendar and see if the date. And then I've got to see if I got my kids that night.
That's very adult of you.
I'm working on it, man.
Yeah. In a calendar. I use the Google Calendar.
Don't
understand.
Don't say that, because Leslie's like, I want access to your Google Calendar. And I was like, I don't know.
Leslie and I are going to get you to do the Google Calendar, because I don't know how people survive today without it. You can have it all color coordinated. Oh. It gives you alarms on your phone telling you when something's coming up.
You're speaking Leslie's love language right now.
Oh, man. If I didn't have that, there is no way I could do everything I do all week.
All mine's up in my head.
No, that's a bad idea.
It is ugly.
Your brain will let you down.
Oh, it has. Hey, we've got a great guest for you today. His name is Dan Fosmark, and we met him about 3 years ago when we spoke at the recovery event for Bannon Recovery, and Brandon Novak
with
was
Brandon
there.
Novak. Yeah, that's right. Of course,
we're gonna hear his story coming up. You're listening to Project Recovery.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Both of us have met our guest today. It was 3 years ago. We had Brandon Novak on. He was speaking in downtown Salt Lake for Bannon Recovery Center. And I remember meeting you, Dan. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing, Casey?
Dan's a big man, and you'll be able to see his photo if you go check us out on Facebook. But Dan, that was 3 years ago.
It was.
But you just recently told me you have about 18 months of sobriety. So I went to Ogden High. My math's not the best, but there's probably some hiccups in between there.
Yeah, there's been many hiccups in between there.
All right, before we get to the story and all that stuff, tell us about little Dan Fosmark.
Little Dan Fosmark. I got to correct you on the last name.
Fosmark. You're a big man. I won't mess it up again.
It's happened all my life. Just don't let it happen again.
Okay, I won't.
Sorry.
I got you.
We'll be fine. I grew up in Clearfield, Utah. My dad is Michael Fosmark. He's in banking. My parents are still married. My mom, beautiful mother Julie. They just celebrated, I want to say 42 something years. So,
which is amazing.
They're rock stars.
Love it. Yeah, I love to hear that.
They've really shown me you know what it looks like to have a ride or die, like you were talking about, you know?
Yes.
Like someone who's just going to be there when it all falls apart, you know?
And it will.
Regardless of what. So that's been a good model for me. But so I grew up in Clearfield. I have two brothers. One's 2.5 years older than me, Brady. And Riley is 4 years younger. I'm 36. So
you're definitely right in the middle.
With
a good space between.
Good space, yeah. Good Norwegian genes.
Yeah, you got that red beard, those big muscles. Yeah. I mean, you look like a Viking.
Yeah, we have a...
Cornrows?
We don't have a small family.
Big guys.
Yeah, Costco has benefited a lot from my family.
From the Fosmarks.
Yeah. I grew up playing football. Football was kind of my thing.
Would you say it was your identity?
Yeah, it was wrapped up. It was definitely wrapped up in that. My dad was a college football player. And to this day, I mean, my dad's not in my mind still really isn't like a human being. Like he's the archetype of what a man should be, you know?
Kind of larger than life.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the best man I've ever met.
That's awesome. I love it when a kid can say that about their parents. Great.
Talk about integrity. And that's been a battle for me to be able to come from where I've come from, knowing what a childhood I had that was great, you know, and being able to wrestle with that and coming to terms and be able to, you know.
Do you feel like your childhood was pretty typical? Any big setbacks or problems growing up?
There's just not a lot of trauma, but man, being a kid's hard.
Yeah, growing up's not easy.
Yeah, growing up hard. Everything that you experience as a kid, you know, shapes how you see the world, how you perceive everything around you. So like. Just me and my brothers, I mean, we grew up in the same household, same parents, we're vastly different people, vastly different stories.
Call that non-shared experiences. So even twins growing up in the same household, you have non-shared experiences, and that accounts for why people are different, you know. And then especially if you have, you know, these brothers that are, you know, 3.5 and 4 years separate from you in age, you know, the parents that they got were a little different than the parents that you got because of the different ages and parental experiences and finances and all that kind of stuff. And so even though a family can be very close and love to be together and, like you said, not really have a lot of trauma, have really good experiences, everybody's a little different because you do have non-shared experiences.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think just being different ages, psychologically, I mean, you know, that period when you're, you know, 3 to 5 years old, when you just really form all these, you know, character traits and core beliefs, you know, like a source of abandonment, like just out of small memories that you have, like, you know, your dad going to work and like not knowing, like you're three, you don't know if your dad's
gonna come back
or not.
I don't know if he's,
you know, like
back.
You don't know. You can't process that information, but that could plant a seed. And if it's nurtured, then that can grow into something that you struggle with down the road, you know?
So you had a pretty normal childhood. You said not much trauma. When mm-hmm. somebody says not that much trauma, was there some trauma?
No. You know, like as far as like, you know, Big family events, deaths. There was never any substance use in the house growing up. I always felt like I kind of was different than everybody else. I think it's probably pretty common on for addicts and alcoholics. Kind of just a restless, irritable, and discontent with the present circumstances.
Are your brothers always athletes like you, and are they big like you?
They are athletes. My older brother was an All-American. He has a sack record up at Weber State. He stellar defensive end. My little brother played high school ball and college ball. I played high school ball, this is kind of where the addiction jumps off. I blew my shoulder out when I was a junior in high school. And had to get it totally like reconstructed, my labrum and everything. And that started a journey a struggle with painkillers. And I ended up having 5 surgeries in the next 4 years. So that critical time in my life where all my buddies are leaving on missions, I'm transitioning from high school to I can't play football. My basically my life dream is shattered because that's just kind of what I always wanted to do, and it was a realistic goal. You know,
I venture to just jump in there and say it might have been more intense for you as a life goal than the average person because you had a father that you felt was larger than life that played college football.
Mm-hmm. All-American brother.
Yeah. All-American brother.
Dad was an All-American.
Yeah, yeah. Dad's an All-American. Older brother's an All-American. Yeah. And you're also that middle child. And the middle kid sometimes feels a little passed over. And so middle kids can be a little more discontent with finding their place in the world, and they can act out a little bit more. And it's like, if that thing that you thought you were going to do to sort of be part of the brotherhood of the family, you know, mm-hmm. to define yourself, that's taken away with a severe injury, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the addiction on top of that, that can create a lot of anger that a kid that age, 17, 16, doesn't really even understand.
Yeah, it was definitely that. It was kind of a perfect storm. So I wasn't really sure, like, kind of who I was. And, you know, all these people that I kind of grew up with are, like, leaving, going on, you know, church missions. And I grew up a non-LDS, non-denominational Christian family.
And just for some of the listeners, like, Clearfield, especially back in those days, high dense population of Mormons, Church mm-hmm. of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints.
Yeah.
And so when after high school, a lot of your friends probably were going to serve
we're going
a mission.
Yeah, like LDS missions.
Yeah,
and
so they were
taking a two-year.
That's a two-year commitment. And it gives you, I think, it gives you kind of that sense of purpose where after high school, a lot of people sort of struggle. Okay, you know, what am I going to do now? Am I going to play a sport? Am I going to go to college? Am I going to work? Am I going to get a trade? Am I going to military? Yeah. And you're kind of dumb at that age. So you don't really know what to do. And so I think in some ways for the Mormon kids going on those two-year missions, it feels kind of like, oh, I don't have to think about that bigger long-term stuff because I have this commitment and it feels good. And I've known a lot of people who either are LDS and just aren't going or grow up not LDS. They can feel sort of left behind because they're like, oh, all my buddies are either heading off on a scholarship to play ball somewhere or they're heading off on this LDS mission and I feel sort of lonely and directionless. And I don't know if that's how you were feeling.
Yeah. Well, interesting story. It worked out, in my favor. I ended up being pretty good at throwing shot put. Just kind of something to fall back on. So I didn't have to wrestle in the off season because it was just like, you know, a lot of wrestling and I like to lift weights, but I don't really like to, you know, wrestle. So,
Casey was a wrestler, right?
I'll throw shot put.
I wrestled a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll throw shot put, and then I won't have to run a lot. I could just throw this metal ball because I'm, you know, strong. And I ended up being pretty good at that and won the state championship my junior and senior year, 5A.
Wow.
And so I end up with a full ride scholarship for track with these shoulder injuries. But with all that success – That wasn't what I had envisioned for my life, and so it was not okay.
Before we get into the college years, and I want to go back to high school a little bit. Did you dabble with alcohol? Did you dabble with anything in high school, or was the first time that you got your shoulder worked on your first experience into substance?
I think I can't remember like the first time I drank. It wasn't like an epic moment or anything like that. But I do remember getting pain pills for the first time and going like, okay, this not only takes the edge off of this, like, you know, big incision that I have in my shoulder, but it also like, I don't have to feel like any insecurity or I don't have to feel like I'm somehow didn't measure up to my expectations or the bar that my perception of the bar that was put for me.
Talk about that for a little bit. Cause you said you felt kind of different, mm-hmm. you know, as a teenager, can you expound on that? Like in what ways or when did you notice you felt a little different? Cause it sounds to me like some of that emotional stuff, that interpersonal stuff was being treated also by the opiate. Like there was a change.
Yeah.
There.
Well, the opiates did way more than physical. Physical pain is something that's like not that big of a deal. Like you just get through physical pain. But But like taking the edge off of like feelings of insecurity or like or self-esteem.
A lot of people might look at you and be like, oh, come on. You're a big, big guy. Big,
you can bench
strong,
press beat up bugs.
Yeah, come on. I mean, you know, big, strong, good looking guy playing football. How could he have some insecurities?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm looking at my older brother who's an All-American in college football, and he's, you know, getting looks at for college combine or for pro combines, and he's getting, you know, pro day and all that stuff, and I'm throwing shot put. And that's a blessing. Like that paid for, you know, it paid for school, and you know, it was a super big, cool thing that I got to do. But my mind state then was very ungrateful because that wasn't what I, because
it
perceived.
Wasn't football. It and wasn't that's football, what you wanted to do.
And because Fosmarks played football, and that's what I was supposed to do. And if I couldn't do that, then I was somehow fell short of the mark. And that was somehow whether. Consciously or subconsciously, that ate at me for a long time.
And what a lot of people don't understand, we say on the show that, you know, addiction is no respecter of persons, right? We've said that a lot. It doesn't matter who you are,
doesn't
what your background. But you know what? Insecurities are the same. Like, their insecurities do not discriminate. Everybody has insecurities. And when you're at that age, that's a pretty big insecurity because I know what it was like at that age. You had your mind set on something, and a lot of kids, you haven't had enough knockdowns in life yet to be flexible in your thinking, where you're like, okay, well, that did work out. We'll move on to something else. When you're 16, 17, you're going to be a football player. You don't want to be the track kid. You don't want to, yeah, you know, play tennis. You don't want to be a golfer. Like, football was what was in your head. And even though now you can look back on it and say, I was grateful for that opportunity, paid for school. There's nothing not manly about throwing a shot, but it just wasn't football,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so it's important for people to understand that everybody harbors insecurities, and if we don't figure out healthy ways to deal with them, we'll figure out unhealthy ways to deal,
yeah,
with them.
And so, like I said, there wasn't a lot of trauma when I was growing up, but that was traumatic for me. You know, that was the you know, the time in my life where it was supposed to be like all coming together and it was all falling apart.
All the hard work, everything that you've done.
All the hard work. Like, I mean, we're talking like from playing football at 8 years old. That was the plan.
Were you competitive with your older brother? Were you always like, I mean, he's a lot older than you, so maybe not directly competitive, but.
Well, he's a couple years older than me. We're definitely directly competitive, but we both have a lot of respect for each other.
But I mean, as a kid, you might have been like, oh, I'm going to be better than my older brother.
Whatever he ran the 40 in, I'm going to run it in faster. Yeah. Whatever he could lift, I'm going to lift a little bit more. I mean, that's how I am with all my brothers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very competitive. It's healthy, but it's very competitive.
Yeah, he was an athlete, and I'm a little bit thicker build. I'm 6'2", 68 or so right now.
What did you play in football? What position?
I played center and D tackle, and I played high school ball at 265. So
what?
I was a large child.
Wow, that's a big high school ball player.
Yeah, and I was squatting over 600 pounds and benching over 300. And
so you were a legend, man. Like, that's a high school legend.
When I say the there was an opportunity to potentially have a career or play football for a period of time, like,
oh, for
that
sure
was a,
see,
a,
I played
a very
high
school. Real. It was a very real dream. It wasn't
Dr. Matt
just
played for BYU.
There you go.
Well, played is an overstatement.
but he's on the team.
A little bit, barely. But like, I played all through high school. And actually, my buddies and I just got together for like a 30-year reunion recently. And we were talking about kids from other schools. Because within your, you know, district and stuff, some of the big guys become legends. Like, oh, you remember this guy? And I'm like, oh, yeah, we're all scared of him. He was so big, you know, because we were just like skinny little punks, you know. And so I'm sure that your presence on the football team was noticed and known by other schools. So this is I'm not trying to beat a dead horse here. What I'm trying to do is help the listener understand this is a big fall in a kid's expectations.
Yeah.
When you are that big of a deal, and he didn't say that. I said that, but I know, you know, from being a high school football player, and you get to know the other schools and the other teams and who's going to get a scholarship.
You know,
and
who's got a shot, you know, to go further.
Further. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and you're like, you know, I could kick a football. So I got a little bit of a chance to do some of that past high school, but most, you know who they are. Right. And so if you're that guy who everybody's like, oh yeah. Yeah, he's going to go. His dad went. His brother went. He's going to go. He's going to play someplace big. And then to have that taken away, that is a huge difference between most of us regular guys trying to play high school football who are like, oh, yeah, it's okay. I just want people to understand that while you didn't have trauma in your family life growing up necessarily, that is a traumatic event. That really does make an impression that was probably your biggest first challenge in life to have to deal with.
Yeah, and it really set the tone for kind of how I perceived myself for a lot of years, you know. And I always had an imposing exterior, I guess. But I've always been like a super insecure person, like just really, it was funny talking about being a yes man or trying to,
make everybody happy.
Yeah. So if I can kind of jump into a little bit of the recovery part for me.
Yeah.
I went to my first rehab when I was 20. And it was a hospital, like a outpatient program. And I learned some things, and every step of the way, I've been to like 9 rehabs every step of the way. You know, in the 15 years that I was like legitimately trying to figure out why I kept doing the things I was doing, I learned a lot of really good stuff, and I went to I did the 12 step stuff and all that kind of stuff, but I ended up at Odyssey House, and there I learned through the most incredible woman, she was my therapist. Teaching me about thinking errors and core values and how people pleasing. So the way like my life kind of worked, I was always doing things or trying to be like the shining stars to get approval because I needed exterior validation. And so the motive for a lot of my doing things was to either gain some favor in the future for something I'm going to do, because I'm probably going to do something to screw this up. Mm-hmm. And I need some, I need to put some savings in there, or I'm making up for something on the back end. But I'm going to be very, very available and very, very agreeable in order to basically manipulate and get what I want for my selfish means. But I didn't know I was doing that. In my mind, I'm a people pleaser.
You're just being a good guy, right?
Being a good guy, but every time I try to do something for you and I have an expectation on how you're going to react to that, and I haven't told you what that expectation is, and you react, and you're never going to react exactly how I want you to react.
Right.
It's never going to be the same because I haven't expressed that to you. And so then I feel like I fell short somewhere. And so then I beat myself up and I say like, I'm not doing this right. I got to do better. I don't like this feeling that I have. So maybe if I drink or use, like, this feeling would go away. And then when I do that, then it starts this guilt and shame, and then I end up doing something that I shouldn't do. And then I have to people please in order to calm the waters.
So it seems like we got a little insight of how this works for you. So what I want to do now is go back to that first surgery. Mm-hmm. And you said you had, I think, 5 and 4 years. The first surgery takes, you get your pain medicine, and do you take it as it's intended, or do automatically from the get-go you went, hey, this is some good stuff?
Well, it was early 2000s, so there wasn't like, nowadays there's a lot more
education.
There's, there's an epidemic. People are, just dropping like flies. I've been to so many funerals. It's
Sad.
36, and I've been to so many people. My buddies have died. Like it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, and that's why we call it. If people think we're overstating it when we say there's an opioid epidemic, we're not.
Oh,
that's proof.
Die from heroin than in a year that died from COVID.
Yeah.
Single year times a lot.
And 2000, we were still in the thick of it with very little education.
Yeah, very little education. And, and OxyContin was being produced, and they had come out with this finding, Purdue, the university that synthesized that stuff, came out, and they were like, this is a non-addictive substance. And so no one really knew, and the doctors – I was a scholarship athlete. The first surgery, I was just getting back, trying to play football some more. And then the next surgery, now I'm a scholarship athlete. So now they're paying for school. So now I'm an asset. I'm making money for, potentially making money for a program. And they're paying for my way to go to school. So obviously my health care is going to be a little probably better. I'm going to have a lot more freedom.
Oh, yeah. Student athletes can walk in and get the full treatment all the time. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything that I needed as far as like massage or medicine or whatever I needed, shots, whatever I needed to get through what I needed to get through to perform and do my job. That's what I had to do. And so I was vastly uneducated and these things, just made life just seem a lot better. It was just like that sense of ease and comfort that like that first drink gives a lot of people. I think that first, pill gave me that sense of, I'm okay.
When did you, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you the question. You can think about it while we take a break. When did you start to notice it becoming a problem? You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery. Our guest today is a big man, Dan Fosmark. How you doing, buddy?
I'm great. How you doing?
So we're talking to you about your first surgery. You blew your shoulder out playing football. They tried to put it back together. The second time it got hurt, kind of ended your football career. But you end up throwing shot put on the collegiate level for Weber State University, home of the Wildcats. I know that because I live right by there.
You're the spokesperson.
Yeah, I'm on the field. But I asked you a question before we went to break. When did you know that the pain pills were becoming a problem for you?
They didn't become a problem for me.
That's an addict answer right there.
For a lot of years.
That's an addict answer.
With a big smile on his face.
They became a problem for other people. Pretty quick. I definitely am. I'm not a guy that does anything at a gear one.
Yeah, I mean, and what we've learned on this podcast is
comes on the show. Yeah, nobody does anything halfway.
Yeah. No, it's that all or nothing mentality.
Yeah, I'm gonna lift all the weights, and I'm gonna, I'm just gonna.
I'm gonna drink all the beers.
Yeah,
I'm gonna do all the coke. I'm gonna do what? Yeah, I mean, that's what it is.
Ended up being a half gallon of gin guy a day.
Wow.
Sheesh. Just because I just am that guy.
Yeah.
So,
but it's interesting that you said that. It wasn't a problem for me. And that's, I mean, here's my voice to my ex-wife.
Yeah.
It's not your
I'm
problem.
Fine.
I'm fine.
Why are you bothered?
Why are you bothered by it?
Yeah.
I mean, I know now looking back, it was a problem because addiction is a family disease, but you're so.
So who were some of the first people that had a problem with your opioid use?
Definitely my parents. I think they always kind of knew I was – I'm just a lot more, outgoing, just a little bit different than my brothers. Just a little more, free, I guess. Just less reserved. So I was always kind of like life of the party. So I was trying everything, whatever. I didn't care a whole lot. It wasn't a big deal. But my parents started like, noticing just being different, just like kind of numb. Just not, this time I'm fighting some like serious depression, you know, with all that stuff going on, like not being able to play football anymore and all that kind of stuff. New school, new people, you know, all that kind of. So I'm fighting some depression. I'm seeing doctors and they're over prescribing me Xanax and Ambien and antidepressants, and pretty soon I'm literally watching myself walk through life, just being a numb.
Just so your parents probably noticed a more of a withdrawal.
Yeah,
your normal personality.
Yeah, I don't think they knew quite what to do, because it was, you know, on one hand, you know, this is they were uneducated as I was, and so you don't really know the potential for a problem.
Well, and back then, we talk about it now because we've all had at least some level of education about it. But back then, that just wasn't something people even understood. Even a lot of physicians that were prescribing it didn't really understand what was going on. So your parents, we wouldn't expect them to know.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Big Pharma wasn't saying this stuff was highly addictive and it was going to ruin people's lives and the catastrophe that was going to be evident in your
The
wake of destruction in your life. You know?
So does that lead you to your first time at the age of 20 into a treatment center?
Yeah.
What was the catalyst for you getting help then?
I think my parents were just like kind of felt like I, you know, something was
What about
on.
Coaches? Like, did anybody that you?
It's not a real visible thing. Yeah. Like, you know,
performing well, throwing shot put. You weren't kind of like, whoa.
You weren't missing the field.
Well, I was. You know, in college, I was mostly hurt. I was 5 surgeries in 4 years, so very little actual competition, because as soon as I rehabbed up, you know, I'm throwing hammer or shot put or something or lifting, and, you know, I'm blowing my shoulder again.
He looks like Thor.
Yeah.
And throwing the hammer.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. So I didn't have a lot of chance to perform.
Gotcha. I was always so coaches might have just been used to you being out.
Kind of, you know, at that point.
Let me bring this point up. My dad once said he didn't know his dad had a drinking problem until he saw him sober. And that means he knew his dad always drunk. And so if your coaches and everybody only knew you always on these pills, they didn't know to expect anything different. The only person that would have real insight into, you know, your personality and what it is was your parents. And they sounded like they were the first ones to notice.
Yeah, my mom, man. My mom's. My mom's she's solid. She's the most solid person.
So what was yours? So they came to you, I guess, and said, hey.
Yeah, they pulled me in. I was living at, me and my buddy had a little house just in Clearfield. We were just kind of partying, hanging out. I was kind of done with athletics at that point. I couldn't throw anymore or anything. 5 shoulder surgeries, kind of just, all right, we're going to hang this up. And so I was selling cars at the time for my dad's good friends up in Morgan.
Morgan?
The Barbers, Brothers.
Yeah. I'm from Morgan.
Yeah, Barber Brothers, Ford and Morgan.
Sure.
Shout out to John Barber, my dude. So I was working for him. They're, you know, my parents' best friends. And they just kind of pulled me in. It's like, yeah, we think something's going on, and you know, we want you to go to help. And I'm like, okay, because this is people pleasing, right?
Yeah,
and I'm gonna do this because everyone's gonna be so happy when I complete this thing, and I'm just gonna be able to do whatever I want because, you know, I'll
get a free
jump
pass
through the hoop.
Yeah.
So I did. It was an outpatient program, and I, you know, skated by and kind of faked it and knew all the right things to say. And, you know, pretty charismatic, so I kind of can figure out how to navigate the room, you know, pretty good and tell everybody what they want to hear. But I wasn't just wasn't me, you know?
That's the George Costanza method. It's not a lie if you believe it.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of people come in to rehab with that mentality, right? Like you've convinced yourself.
Well, you don't know it's a lie at that point.
Yeah, because you convinced yourself. You think you're telling it's delusional, but you have to have, it's a lot of work to have somebody help you realize that you lie first to yourself and then to everybody else.
But then the other part of that is that you pass an outpatient treatment program like that, and you come through, and you start to believe that you're invincible.
Because I'm fine.
I just went through all these guys who are supposed to be professionals, and they didn't know. Yeah. I am that good. I am okay.
Well, yeah, we're like, I just kind of felt like I had it licked.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, this stuff's, you know, it's not that big of a deal.
So is this when are you just doing pain pills at this point?
You know, drink it. I always drank a little bit. You know, it was never like super intense until later.
Yeah.
You know, I was in college, so obviously I was, you know,
partying
and doing my thing. And so I was drinking quite a bit, but I always, you know, opiates were always kind of my go-to.
That was your jam.
Yeah. I haven't done opiates in years now. But
were you able to continue to get prescriptions during that time, or did you have to start
Up until the surgery stopped.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of like it cut off. But, you know, and that this goes back to the education thing. Like there wasn't tapers and there wasn't a plan for me to come off of this stuff. And this
and they would just prescribe you a full bottle. Thing, there you go. And
you know, for months on end. And so it was kind of, but at that point it was just kind of how life was, chronic pain, basically always in rehabilitation for my shoulder, you know, and using alcohol and stuff to numb that physical pain, and basically using, you know, well, alcohol helps social situations and painkillers help me not feel any of the feelings that I felt.
How do you find yourself getting into rehab number two?
Rehab number two. Rehab number two was Valley Camp. It was like a AA rehab. Every single time I went to rehab, I did it for somebody else.
Who'd you do number two for?
Parents, always.
Always?
Yeah. And I always wanted to get clean. But I just was ill-equipped. I didn't understand how my mind perceived what was – I didn't understand how my decision-making was counterproductive to my success.
Well, you mentioned that – and that's kind of skipping towards the end of the story, I think. But once you hooked up with a therapist that helped you understand, you know, cognitive distortions, thought – thinking errors, yeah, that's
like
what you
DBT
call it.
DBT.
Yeah, and that's – sounds like that – you know, hadn't happened yet. You're going through and doing the steps, but you hadn't quite, that level of insight is almost magical when it comes to behavior change. When a person realizes what their cognitive distortions are, mm-hmm. what their thinking errors are, that is like unlocking potential.
It is.
But until then, you keep doing the same old stuff.
It was hard because, you know, I see AA, like people in AA, and I see people like super successful, and I just couldn't ever really just kind of figure that out. And it was a thing of, you know, I'm really good when I'm working a program, and then when life gets busy and a couple of those things like fall off by the wayside and I start getting complacent, you know, that's where the train starts, you know, leaving the track. And it, you know, everyone knows it happens far and fast, you know, the next
quick
time. Yeah, real quick.
So what brought you to rehab number three? Was that Valley Camp?
Yeah, I think I've been to Valley Camp like four times.
So that's three, four, five, six.
Yeah, a lot of this is pretty hazy because this is a lot of years of, you know, 15 years of.
But the interesting thing is you said you always went to rehab for somebody else.
Yeah, but it was always a really good idea. No, I was always on board.
No, I
you but know I never went for me.
But what were they seeing? Like I think that mentality. So it's you're an interesting mix in the sense, but there, you know, Casey's a lot this way too, that all or nothing, you know, I'm going to go 110% all the time on anything I do, but I'm also a pleaser. Cause sometimes you get these guys that are, you know, all or nothing guys, but they're not a pleaser and they're very difficult to deal with. Mm-hmm. But you're a pleaser, so you could see the logic in it. What was the logic in it? Like, when they kept coming to you and saying, you need to go to rehab again, you need to go to rehab again, like, why did that make sense to you? What was happening in your life that you could look at and go, yeah, I probably should go?
Oh, man. Well, I have 3 DUIs.
Okay.
So, first one I got in, like, 2009. So, I graduated in 2003. So, 2009, I got my first DUI. Halloween night. And you woke up out of a blackout with the lights behind me, big long red beard, dressed as a nun. You know, I got a half a bottle of promethazine cough syrup in the back of my Jeep, and you know, I'm just left the bar in Ogden, and I'm at Layton IHOP, and I just woke up with the cop car with the cherries by me, and I have no idea how I got there.
Scary.
So
scary,
that was scary. Cool. You know, my dad bailed me out, and he's such a, like, a business guy, and he's so, like, just wise. And he's just like, well, you got to go to work. So I bailed you out so you can go to work, cause you got a lot of stuff to pay for. You know, this is rationally, this is the steps that we're going to take to remedy this situation.
Sounds like a dad response.
Yeah, no, totally. And you know, my mom was devastated. I was devastated. You know what? My older brother, like, life just kind of, I mean, I'm sure he struggles, but he's always kind of just made the right choices. Like, you know, it's been, and, you know, life's, I'm sure it hasn't been easy, but you know, he's been successful.
Getting pulled over.
He makes good decisions.
He knows how he got to IHOP.
He makes good decisions. Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't.
Did that make you feel like a burden to your parents a little bit?
Absolutely. And so then I had to try harder to not be that guy. And, you know, the more you try to not be that guy, the more you feel like crap because you just are that guy, you know?
Because, well, like you said, you were ill-equipped.
Ill-equipped with the skills to be able to navigate life in a way that was productive for me, you know? And it worked for other people. I saw people with years and years and years and stuff in AA, and I never really – and that was a source of guilt and shame too. Why are these people getting it and I can't get it?
What's wrong with me?
Yeah. Why do I keep coming back?
There's 12 steps.
You know, I know that these people are going to be here for me every single time. The best fellowship ever. You know, they're always going to be there with a hug. You know, the greatest people I've met are in those rooms.
But each time you go back, it's a reminder of a failure.
It's a reminder of a failure, and it's a reminder of how I fell short at what I perceived was the expectation for how I was supposed to act in the world.
I don't want to play therapist, but when you said a reminder of how I felt short, I wanted to say again. Because it seems like it's been somewhat of a pattern in there. Mm-hmm. You fell short on the football. You fell short on the rehab. You fell short on this, the DUI. And so you're right, Dr. Matt, when you go back in there, you know, you'll go into these meetings, and if you're not ready, they'll go, you're not ready, but you'll be back.
Yeah.
And you know what it takes to walk through those doors again? Because that guy told you weren't ready. You told him he was full of crap. And here you are coming back, and he's going to go, I told you.
Yeah.
Are you ready to listen?
Yeah. Yeah, the first guy that says, I'll never use again. I promise you, I'll never do that again. It's the first guy that's going to use.
Yep.
Yeah. He just set himself up for it.
So on the podcast, you've got such a fascinating story. 9 rehabs, 3 DUIs. I mean, there's a lot of running and gunning, as they say.
Lots.
But there's usually a rock bottom.
Rock bottom.
And, you know, and you went to 9 rehabs. Where does your, I guess, ultimate rock bottom come in?
My ultimate rock bottom came in, after homelessness. Well, second, so this would be my second bout of homelessness. So you guys are talking about homeless people. So I took it there.
Now, were you still doing pills and heroin, drinking?
I was doing whatever you had. Whatever you had, Casey, I would love to be your friend.
That was, and that was the requirement.
Yeah.
I just had to have something.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you first became homeless?
I mean, it was a short period of time. It was a couple of weeks.
But don't downplay that, because a couple weeks of not having anywhere to go,
it's got to be horrible.
I was trying to get into Valley Camp. I had double ear infection. I was walking from the Lantern House.
And what is the Lantern House?
It is a homeless shelter.
Homeless shelter.
In Ogden.
All right.
And I was walking to the Alano Club, which is the Alcoholics Anonymous Club. But it's, I mean, it's a jaunt. It's like 33rd and Wall to 24th and Washington, you know. So I was walking there every morning, and I was double ear infection. It was cold. I think it was like, February or March. And I was going there because I knew it was safe. I knew I couldn't get into trouble if I was at the Alano Club, because I knew those were safe people, because I'd been in the rooms before. And so that's what I did. And I just kept calling. I'm in a bad enough situation to where I don't have anywhere to go. So now I'm going to take some steps to try and
get back
to build my comfort back up.
Had your parents sort of withdrawn their support? Is that how you became homeless?
Yeah. So it was basically at that point, it was like, you know, what do you want us to do?
They sort of felt like they tried everything.
We've kind of done everything. Like we've paid for this and we paid for that, and you know, we've been supportive. You know, we don't have the stuff in our house. We've afforded you every luxury in life you could possibly imagine. You got good grades in school. You know, what's the deal? But we're seeing you self-destruct, and we can't just sit and watch it.
And that sounds fair.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Did it feel fair at the time?
Oh, I was pissed. Oh, it was the worst. Like, these people supposed to love me. And they loved me right through it. And I got in there, and I got some clean time, and I got kind of bounced back, and then I got complacent, you know? And I got successful for a minute, you know?
Yeah.
I got a roof and, you know, car back and all that kind of stuff, and stuff started to get comfortable again. And then all of a sudden that sense of, you know, desperation, just kind of goes away.
And was your DOC heroin at this point?
So I've never used intravenously, which I'm so happy, that I've never done that. 'Cause that, you know, the fact that I'm still alive today is a miracle enough. But if I would have got the needle, I probably would.
What stopped you from using a needle?
I think it was just kind of lack of opportunity. Hmm. So I was getting painkillers, and then I'd get, you know, black tar heroin, but we were too good for that. We were too good to shoot it, because we weren't junkies.
Yeah.
So we smoked on tin foil. So, yeah. You know.
But that's a real thing.
Oh, yeah. Well,
absolutely.
That's a real
thing.
There's a class part of that delusional thinking where you lie to yourself that,
there's
well, at
a
least
hierarchy
I'm not as bad as
everywhere.
Those guys.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
There's a hierarchy in drugs, and people that do this don't like people that do that, and because they act like this, and they don't like people that take apart an entire lawnmower in 30 seconds, and you know, and this guy can't keep his eyes open for an hour, you know?
Yeah.
So there's like a clash in there, and people judge each other.
So you get some sober time. You find some success. You said you got a roof over your head. You got a car, probably got some money in your pocket. What leads you to take it again for a test drive? And what was it that you took for a test drive?
Oh, at that point, I couldn't even tell you. I can't even remember. But it didn't matter what it was, because I didn't really care. It wasn't the feeling I was getting. It was the lack of feeling that I was chasing. Like, I didn't want to feel, you know, so whatever it was, like, I wasn't chasing the high, so to speak. I was chasing the numb.
Yeah, I just wanted to numb out.
Yeah, I just didn't want to feel this stuff. And I did a lot of that isolated because it's a shameful thing. Like I didn't drink with other people. I went to bars and like I partied a little bit, and I did that in college and stuff, but when I was drinking, like, no one wanted to watch me drink a half gallon of you know, bottom of the barrel stuff. Like, no one wants to watch someone do that because that's weird. You know, it's like, no one, you know, that's not okay.
Yeah.
You know? And so it gradually became so isolated.
Well, and it sounds like you were drinking or using to numb out, which tells me that, you know, this was self-medicating all the way. Absolutely. This isn't fun. Nobody's enjoying being around you.
No, it stopped being fun really quick.
Yeah, you're trying to withdraw and treat something that was going on. What do you think that was inside? Was it the losses you'd had with things?
No,
or?
It was just a total, I think, lack of self-worth. I think I just always felt like I was just somehow, like, short of the mark. I just couldn't quite figure it out. And I was watching people that I loved in my life be successful and figure it out. And that was, you know, I couldn't understand what I was doing so wrong.
Well,
to have these things happen to me. Because there was a lot of stuff that happened that was like unfortunate,
yeah.
You know, like shoulder surgery after shoulder surgery, you know, that stuff's kind of like doesn't happen to everybody.
But in your own words, in your parents' words, I mean, you were afforded every luxury that life had to offer. You had good grades, a full ride scholarship. Things mm-hmm. that people dream of. I mean, you had them, and somehow it didn't work out for you.
It wasn't ever enough, because nothing's ever enough. You know, when everything has to come from somewhere else to make it okay. Like, I think of Las Vegas. Las Vegas will never be okay because it can't sustain itself. It can't be okay.
All the money,
you know,
comes from outside.
Everything has to come in, and food has to come in, and water has to come in, because it's a desert.
Well,
it can't sustain life. And so
from a psychologist's point of view, what you're talking about is the true definition of self-esteem, and I'll explain really quick. So when somebody, parents with your kids, if you're listening, you can try this out at home tonight. You take a kid has a success. It doesn't have to be an A, but let's say they do well on a quiz at school, or they have a good game in their sports, or they learned a new song on their violin. So any sort of little improvement or success. So what do we do as parents, or, you know, teachers or whomever? We celebrate it. We say, hey, good job, buddy. That was awesome. You did well on this thing that you just did. Good job. And he's happy or she's happy. You're happy. Everybody's happy. But we don't know where that person, the child in this case, is attributing the success. We don't know where it's going. They're happy because, I mean, you're always happy if you got a good grade and your dad says good job. And, I mean, that feels awesome. So what you have to do is you take it a step further and you say, how did you do that? How did that happen? So we don't stop at the celebration. We say, how did that happen? That's the magical question, because now you're going to find out where that kid is attributing their success. If they externalize it, like Las Vegas, if they say it came from somewhere else, the queen mother is, I got lucky. But it could be something like, oh, my coach is awesome, or my teacher's great, or everybody did well, or we played an easy team, or the test wasn't really that hard. If they give away the responsibility, then we know that did not put a brick in the foundation of their self-esteem. Mm. It just floated away. It was just fluff. Yes. If they can say, well, you know, I studied extra. Instead of playing more video games, I made those flashcards, and I think that's why. Or, you know what, I stayed after practice and worked on some stuff with my coach or my teacher. If they can somehow own part of that success, like, I did something that led me to that, they've internalized it, and we call that a mastery experience. And do not discount how important mastery experiences are, because I'll bet if we could go back to younger you, teenage you, a lot of your successes, most likely you were externalizing the responsibility. You might have been like, well, it's because, even things like, I'm a good football player because my family, my everyone else are good football players,
mm-hmm.
right? Or it's because my body's big. That sounds like ownership, but it's not. It's like, well, I'm bigger than, like, you were playing, when I was playing high school football, I was probably 100 pounds lighter than when you were playing 100. Like, hitting Matt Woolley when I was weighing like 155, You know, I would have pinged off you like a ping pong ball, right? You're over 200 pounds in high school. So even that, a kid that big could be like, well, I'm big, but you don't own it. I'm not big because I built myself. Mm-hmm. I'm just big, or the family's big, or whatever it is. So that's something to keep in mind, is a person on the outside can have all the privileges. They can have lots of success. Mm-hmm. They can have a trophy on the shelf. They can have a scholarship in the can. They can have all this kind of stuff. But if they give away the responsibility for how those things happened, it actually doesn't build their self-esteem, and those insecurities grow instead.
Yeah.
Well, if you give away the responsibility, you don't really own it.
Yeah, there's no ownership. And it's not cocky. Mm-hmm. Cocky is owning something that you didn't do.
Yeah.
I'm amazing because I'm amazing. You know, you didn't do anything. And so it's also fluff, but on the other end of the scale. But real ownership is a person who can say, well, you know what? I believe in myself. If I work hard at something, I can create a better outcome.
I love it.
But most of the time when a person is self-medicating, any of the successes they've had in life, or most of them, they've learned to externalize and give away to something else, even just to luck.
So, Dan, how do you find yourself in your last treatment center that got you on your road to 18 months of sobriety?
I want to touch real quick on what you're saying.
Yeah, do it.
Before I do that. I really like that. And what I think I was doing was I was owning that, but the outcome wasn't what I had projected the outcome to be.
Uh-huh, okay.
So I was owning what I had done. I had done every rep in that gym to be able to afford myself the ability to play football. I did that. But it was taken away from me by this injury.
So therefore, did you interpret that as I'm not good enough?
Yes.
Because I put everything into it and I failed.
And I fell short.
Yeah.
And I wasn't successful in getting the mark.
And when that happens for a person, for the things that a person values in their life,
mm-hmm.
you know, other people may not know what you value, but you know what you value. And if you come up short over and over again on the things that you value, boy, that's hard for that not to tear your self-esteem down.
Well, and I was winning these shot put. Like, I didn't, like, lose a meet my junior and senior year. I got invited to Russia to throw shot put after high school.
That's awesome.
2 weeks. And it was like this life experience. But none of that stuff, because that wasn't what I worked for. So all the work went into playing football. And all the stuff that I was just naturally good at that I didn't own, that was 100% individual effort. Football was a team sport.
Yeah.
But individual effort, I did all that stuff. And it wasn't ever – I never looked at it as me doing all that stuff and winning those trophies and those medals. It was, I'm doing this because it's the alternative to what
– because I wasn't good enough to play football.
Because it didn't pan out the way I wanted it to pan out.
Wow. So, that's heavy stuff. And think about how mature are any of us at that age. Like, we don't have the maturity to handle that kind of stuff.
You know, it's a lot. Yeah. You know? It's a sense of loss for sure. You know, what finds me at my last rehab. So I get the third DUI, and I do like the jail and all that kind of stuff. And I get on work release and I'm out and, doing good. And I just start drinking again. I, you know, didn't really care. I was doing like commercial roofing, you know, I just kind of whatever. It didn't really matter. I was kind of like at this point, I was atheistic, and I was just so beat up that I was just like
kind of giving up on life.
Yeah, I've tried this so many times. It's 15 years of just like getting just beat up. You know, trying like really wanting to get sober and having, you know, some time like put together a year here. You know, some months there and have it be really good, solid recovery, but it never could be sustained. I couldn't figure that out, part out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I violated probation. I went back to jail. And at this point I'm like, I'm 30, you know, 5 years old. And I'm like, this is just not getting any better. So I begged the judge to let me go to a program, and I wrote Red Barn. You know Red
Barn?
Yeah. So I wrote Red Barn and I went there. And it wasn't a good fit for me. It's a kind of a behavioral modification, more of not really a really good program, not centered around psychology and how the brain kind of works and stuff, which is my jam. I think where my recovery makes sense to me. So it didn't work out. And I remember leaving there and I walked from Farmington to East Layton because no one had picked me up. And I'm at my parents' house, it's like 6 a.m.
It's a really long walk just really for the listeners.
Yeah. And yeah. Getting kicked out, basically the only thing I have is like basically the clothes on my back, you know? And I walk there and I get there, you know, I basically walk all night and I get there cause that's the only place I know where, that's the only place I have to go. You know, that's like the only place I can go, you know? And I remember my dad and mom opening the door and they already know, it's like, you know, cause you know, the place called them chain of custody, you know, for people in their program. And I remember my dad just not even letting me in to the house without him being there with me, like getting a bag of clothes, like in the bedroom that I had, cause I had like coming and gone, like I was homeless for a while. And then I lived there, you know, I kind of got, you know, good at navigating that whole situation over the years and manipulating and stuff. And they got smart over the years and just like, we can't do this anymore. Just not going to do it. So they're like, bye. So I went and stayed at Layton Park. And that was a week of homelessness and it was my birthday. And this was June 3rd of 2020. And I drank the day before and it was my birthday and I called my PO and I was like, man, I left that rehab. I know I'm looking at 0 to 5. I'm a felon, so I'm probably going to prison, you know, if the judge doesn't, you know, let me into somewhere else, doesn't take another chance on me. And he says, go to this kind of like a holding place for people trying to get into treatment, like Davis County. Super cool deal. It's like their old PO spot, like in Farmington.
Yeah.
They basically just try and get people into recovery. Like that are, you know, cops will actually bring people that are, like getting arrested, but like not like, we're not going to take you to jail. Cause obviously you need help. You know, we're going to take care of getting into a program. So they got me into Odyssey House and I knew Odyssey House was like, you know, I've heard just nothing but horrible things in jail from, you know, hard program.
Oh, it's not one of, I mean, it's a good program and has helped a lot of people get sober, but it's not a palace and it's not
a walk in the park.
No.
This is behavioral modification at its finest. And they have a model that works for them and they've done it for a lot of years. And I was at the end of my rope and I was just like, you know what? I've tried everything. I'm just going to give this a shot. I don't have anything to lose, literally nothing to lose.
But this is the first time you're going to a treatment center, not for anybody else, yeah, but for yourself.
So broken. Just like, all right, this is the last ditch effort. Like it's either this or, you know, I never played with the idea of taking my own life, but it sounded like a good idea for me to not be around anymore.
Yeah,
because I was hurting a lot of people and I couldn't stop. And so I got into Odyssey House and I started learning a lot about like myself and I started developing the self-worth and learning how my mind thinks. And I'm like diving into like podcasts and psychology and I'm just learning as much as I can about how behavior and how these things kind of form and it just starts making a whole lot of sense, you know, that I can catch myself in just by checking my motivation on things. Like, what am I doing this for? Like, am I doing this for something? Am I trying to get something out of this, or am I doing this because, you know, because I genuinely like care for this person and I want to help them, or am I going to get a handout or a hand up, you know, kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be able to bless that person with whatever I'm doing? And if I can say yeah, or if I can go to bed, and my sponsor told me this, if I can go to bed and I didn't make anyone cry today, then that's probably a pretty good day. And I have a lot more of those now than I ever did. And I still have a lot of, you know, a lot of like the character defects and the thinking errors, and I don't navigate, you know, some relationships as well as I should. But I'm learning, I'm figuring it out, and stuff can go like really wrong. And I don't, like, the first thought is not to go to the liquor store or to pick up, you know, and so Aussie House has afforded me, you know, I got into sober living after I got that program, and a buddy of mine from school, Will Harris, owns a private, gym that he does personal training out of. I've been following him because we were buddies in junior high and high school. He's been running that place for about 5 years, and I was living in Murray. And my plan at that point was to go to school to get my Sub-C in substance use disorder counseling. And I'd already known like people in like the fitness recovery industry, and I've always been in kind of fitness and that kind of stuff, and always kind of loved that part of it and kind of wanted to do something like that. And it just so happened to work out that I applied to the University of Utah, and I got denied, but this just opened up. My buddy called me. He's like, "Hey man, I'm expanding my business and I want you to come and be a trainer." I'd never been a personal trainer before. I'd always help people out, you know, doing workouts and everyone, you know, ask questions and stuff like that. Cause I've spent the one thing that was a constant in my life through all of it was the gym. I always stayed in the gym. I never, you know, it didn't matter what I was doing, like what I was putting in my body. I always stayed in the gym because that was the one thing that made sense to me. You know, the barbell made sense to me when everything else, nothing made sense. You know, the barbell did. And so I stayed in there. And so I cut, you know, like a pretty wealth of knowledge in training, you know, people to be better. And now I have like this, you know, kind of story to where I can help people be better people, and I can help them, you know, get their fitness goals in line. And so I'm doing that full time now, and that's killer. And my life's better than I could ever even possibly imagine.
That's amazing.
And my life, like with my parents, like is incredible.
I love your mom.
She's the most incredible person. She's the best person on this earth. And I will fight anybody that says that's not true.
And I don't want to fight you. Well, I think it's great what you're doing. And you're, once again, you're a testament that, you know, eight rehabs wasn't enough, but the ninth one worked for you. And you kept fighting and you kept going, and you ultimately ended up doing it for yourself, which I think is the only way to stay sober. You've got to do it for you. Everybody else benefits if you do. You can't do it for anybody else. But once you figure that out, stuff starts to fall in line. And I like that. Dr. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just appreciate you so much coming on the show and being willing to share your story. I'm always impressed by guests that can come in and be authentic, and I know that's going to touch somebody who's listening today, or many somebodies. I guess I'm trying to kind of pinpoint, it sounds to me like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you're going to correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a turning point, and then what's keeping you on the road. I'd say the turning point was desperation, where you decided, I just have to do this for myself. I have nothing to lose. And that's epic. That's so huge compared to all the other reasons why, you know, people go into rehab for others, you know, good intentions and all that. But that was the turning point. But it sounds like the cognitive change, the psychological change, the understanding yourself, how you think, when you're thinking off track, when you're on track, it seems like that's what's keeping you going these last 18 months. And now you have some other ways of dealing with the problems in life besides running off to the liquor store. Would you say that's kind of one of the main things that's keeping you going in the direction you're headed?
Yeah, absolutely. I can understand like why I think the way I think. I can never understand like why I came to the kind of the conclusions, like why that drink sounded like a good idea. But kind of understanding how I think, I was able to give myself a break. Like I didn't have to be the perfect person. Like my collective experiences has shaped my life, and that's how I perceive the world, is based on what I've experienced, and that's okay.
You know? I think that's true. When a person really starts to understand themselves, you gain empathy for yourself, and you stop beating yourself up, and you really start encouraging yourself. And so I hope that's one of the things people will take away from your story, is that it's great to have other people cheer us on. It feels amazing. But the person that really needs to be our biggest cheerleader is ourself. And I don't think that really happens until we gain empathy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we gain empathy for ourselves if we don't understand ourselves. So I appreciate you sharing that part of your story on the show.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Hey, thank you for stopping by and listening today. Project Recovery is brought to you by our friends at knowyourscript.org. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on kslpodcasts.com. or wherever you get your podcasts.